I call Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, March 31st, 2025. The time is 3:30. Please turn off your cell phones. Members present today, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Myers, Senator Klayman, Senator Dunbar, Senator Hughes. Vice Chair Wilikowski is excused today, and I'm Senator Giesel. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Heather and to Emma for taking the minutes and keeping the recording going. I'm going to start out by announcing an amendment deadline for Senate Bill 92. This is the corporate income tax, oil and gas entities. That amendment deadline will be Wednesday, April 2nd at 8 a.m., and I'll repeat that at the end of the meeting. We're going to have a Fisheries Day today. We're going to start out with a presentation on the Fisheries Task Force report, and then we'll be hearing Senate Bill 130, Fisheries Production Development Tax Credit, and Senate Bill 135, Refund of Fish Business Tax to Municipalities. Lastly, we'll hear HJR 11, which is recognizing the Alaska-Canada relationship. So, starting out today with the Fisheries Task Force report, I welcome Tim Lampkin. He is staff to Senator Stevens to come forward today and give us an overview of that task force report. Welcome, Mr. Lampkin. I like your fish pin.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. For the record, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. Admittedly, I'm a little off guard. I was expecting HGR 11 first today. Senator Stevens is on his way. I think he has some opening comments to share with you, perhaps, going first. However, notwithstanding that, I'm happy to go into the report itself. Before you should be the final report of the task force. It's the result of SCR 10 passed last year. The task force consisted of four senators, four representatives. We met a total of 12 times last fall. I might remind you that it was sort of the impetus behind this project was, in part at least, of course, well, first and foremost, the economic crisis that we were facing as of the previous fishing seasons, and a salmon task force that was started in the early 2000s. And with that, I'll pause and happily give the floor to Senator Stevens.
Thank you. Welcome, Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry I'm late. I had a bunch of people in my office, but Senator Gary Stevens from Kodiak, thank you so much for hearing this bill. So as you may remember, the Alaska Seafood Industry Task Force was appointed last session, SCR 10, and the goal was an effort to try to explore ways the state can assist the seafood industry in recovering from what is a major economic tailspin that we are all facing. The seafood industry, as I'm sure you know, is the largest manufacturing sector in the state. It employs some 48,000 workers. It touches more than 142 communities. In 2001 and 2002, it was the largest source of income for 11 municipalities in the state of Alaska. And the impact on the state is almost $6 billion overall. Enormous impact on the state of Alaska. But with the variety of headwinds, market conditions, economic conditions, including a depressed consumer demand, including a weakened U.S. currency, deflated prices, international overharvesting, those have all made Alaska seafood products less competitive in the market. So our task force met monthly. We hear from a wide variety of stakeholders in the industry, from scientists, business sector owners, businessmen, processors, innovators, fishermen, local government leaders, and as well as state and federal agencies. And to that end, we produced this final report at the end of January in 2025. Some of the recommendations we know are long-term. Others are more swiftly attainable, things we can actually do much more quickly. We spent a very concerted and very focused amount of time trying to find solutions that we can deal with now or eventually in the future for the legislature, and trying to find ways to help turn things around for our seafood industry. Really, thank you for your consideration. I'm I will turn this over to Tim, who has dealt with this, and he handled the meetings and put together the report and knows it all inside and out. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Mr. Lampkin.
Again, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. To resume, so this part of the impetus of this bill or this task force was inspired by some work that was done in the early 2000s. Senator Stevens was on that task force at the time. And it was focused on the salmon industry, and that started in 2002. And that consisted of a 20-some member task force. They met for a year and a half or so. They had an impressively extensive subcommittee process and structure that involved hundreds of stakeholders. I believe there were even conferences being held, and they continued to work for about 2-3 years. And so that task force, its work is out there. The reports are published or archived. It resulted in a portfolio of legislation. And just want to point out that that task force and the complexity and the size of that project was just focused on the salmon industry, salmon fishery. This task force encompassed the entire seafood industry of the state, and we did so with a group of 8 legislators and over the course of about 6 months. So at least from a staff perspective, it was a daunting project to bring this product in front of you. It still has quite a portfolio of legislation, some recommendations, the first three of which, and I'm going to largely go off of this spreadsheet that you should have in your packet. It's a summary of action points. So it takes the 20-some page report and condenses it into a single page or two of items, actionable items. And they're not particularly in per se a 1 through 20 or 30 priority, but they are an attempt to identify those things that are the most immediately actionable. And so before you are a couple of bills that represent those first three items on that spreadsheet, which is action item 7A, B, and number 8. And that is to say this relates to product development tax credits and what I refer to as the fish tax revenue sharing and how those revenues are allocated. I would briefly go through this list just to sort of touch on some of these action items, where they are now, and how and why they're categorized the way they are. We generally had a sort of a finances and tax component to this report. A key element of actionable items included investment in our infrastructure. There was quite a lot of discussions about workforce development in our labor sector. There were some general components about licensing, certainly a federal component to this that included some recommendations for resolutions. There was marketing investments, which is to say through ASME. And then those are the more near-ish term items on page 1. Page 2 are largely mid to long-term things that were noted as something to be addressed, but perhaps not something that we could bring about some effective change anytime real soon. Also, I'd point out that the midterm items largely discuss things that would be driven primarily through budget appropriations. And so, at least in terms of this committee, I would propose that there's not a lot of discussion on the budget components, but rather on page 1, the policy components that we can affect. I'm sorry, I feel like there's some strange technical in and out of the microphone here. So with that, the fourth item down, action item number 10, regards pooling of insurance, risk management among our seafood sector. That is legislation that is in play right now. It's in our Labor and Commerce Committee. Negotiations underway to try to find a way for our fishing fleet to mitigate some of the risk and the insurance needs that they have. 18 involves ADA and Alaska Energy Authority. It does touch largely on budget components, but it's an effort to recognize a need to prioritize our energy generation and grid development in our coastal communities. Item number 9 is an emergency loan program, again through ADA. conceptually, touching on AS 4488, with trying to negotiate some sort of management of contingencies for negative market and harvest events. The next segment, items 6 and 9, touch upon our Commercial Fisheries and Agricultural Bank, CFAB, and the Commercial Fisheries Revolving Loan Fund. As you may recall, we had changed some of the terms for the CFLR program that are now, it was pointed out to us that CFAB is put in a bit of a financial poorly leveraged environment, and that there's an interest out there to try to balance those two programs so that they are at parity with each other and with our fisheries. Things like PAC loans is referenced there, short-term loans for kind of primarily targeted for lack of a better phrase, our smaller processors, more independent Alaskan-based folks that are out there to help them out. Item 22 is underway. It's being drafted. That touches primarily the University of Alaska and our Department of Labor. There's an interest, there has been in quite some time in the past, for allowing them to improve the means by which they can share their data, and that data in turn is provided to the legislative body so we can have better, more concise information when it comes to making policy decisions and appropriations. Item number 3 and 4 touches on the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. There was a lot of discussion about optimizing or looking at the number of permits that are out there, optimization thereof, buyback programs. Those are relatively, depending on who you ask, are controversial. So those are two things. Looking at CFAC, maybe not necessarily near term, as we wade into those waters, we discover that changing CFEC generally is sensitive. There's constitutional considerations that complicate that potential legislation. Another one that's an infrastructural consideration under item 15 would try to seek some nexus between our Village Safe Water Program and what was referred to as community-owned cold storage. That was a theme that came up repeatedly throughout this project. As to how to more widely make cold storage available to the little guys, so to speak. Number two, we've kind of partially addressed as regards the executive order. That came up quite a bit during this process, with particular interest in when it comes to having a Department of Agriculture to include in some way seafood, putting the food in seafood and in the context of a Department of Agriculture. And that legislation is, I think, in your committee now, and so that's going to be something that's visited as that process moves forward. The next chunk of items are all federally related and would be in the form of a joint resolution. Those are largely drafted. I just found so far there might be fatigue on dealing with resolutions, but those are something that we have in our pocket but haven't initially pulled the trigger on those quite yet. And then finally, for the nearer term, of course, is recognizing the need for supplemental and or ongoing investment in ASME, the Seafood Marketing Institute's efforts to promote Alaskan seafood. So, Madam Chairman, that's a summary of the report that's in front of you, and I'm happy to take any questions you may have, or we can dive into those two bills.
Very good. This is impressive, Mr. Lemkin. It almost looks like a theme summary from a qualitative research project. I mean, wow. And I love how you divided them up into near, mid, and who has the authority and things like that. Any questions, committee members, for Mr. Lampkin related to this summary or Senator Stevens related to the task force? All right. See none. Why don't we jump into the bills? So we have Senate Bill 130 up first, Fisheries Production Development Tax Credit. So, Senator Stevens and Mr. Lampkin.
Actually, I'll let Tim, if you don't mind, go ahead with this.
Very good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens and to the Seafood Task Force. Before you is Senate Bill 130. This closely models a bill that Senator Stevens had introduced a few years ago that expanded the value-added tax credits for salmon and herring. I'm going to get my fisheries mixed up as to which one, but I know that we expanded it to include several other fisheries, including pollock and black cod, a sable fish, this bill would open it up to all species. And this was resultant of continuing input testimony from the processing sector to try to acknowledge the complexities of the processing sector and making it a little more flexible in terms of qualifiers for the tax credits. And with that said, I guess I'm compelled to say that this is we're here to honor the recommendations of the task force. And so I am not going to pretend to be a content expert, per se, in any one of these subject matters. I can speak to them generally, but I would defer or prefer to defer to the processors when speaking of the details as to what the language of the bill says. And that'll be kind of a blanket disclaimer for all of the bills coming forward.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Related to what Mr. Lampkin just said, well, first of all, if we have invited testifiers, I can wait until after. But I'm wondering if there's anyone at the Department of Revenue online, because I have DOR-specific questions about this bill.
I have two people from the Department of Revenue. I have Chris Becker. He is the lead auditor, Tax Division, Department of Revenue, and Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director, Tax Division.
Very good.
Who would you like to query?
I think I will wait, Madam Chair, if we have invited testifiers, processors to speak to this first. I'll wait till afterwards.
In terms of invited testifiers, I have Julie Decker online. She's the president of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association. Is she the only invited, Mr. Lampkin?
Tim Lampkin. So at this time, rather than bog the committee down with lot of testifiers, and I specifically targeted, we wanted our revenue tax guys as well. In this instance, Julie Decker with the Processing Pacific Seafood Processing Association. Those are the two point people to hear for today.
Excellent. So let's begin with Julie, and she's on Teams, it says here, but I'll double check that. All right, it'll come up on Teams here in a moment. Ms. Decker, can you hear us?
I can. Can you hear me, Madam Chair?
Yes, and see you as well. Excellent. Well, thank you for joining us to brief us on Senate Bill 130. I will let you go ahead and proceed with that.
Great. Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Julie Decker. I am the president of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association, or PSPA. PSPA is a trade association which represents the major seafood processing companies that purchase fish from thousands of commercial fishermen across the state and process it in facilities in 21 coastal communities from Ketchikan to Cordova to Kodiak and to Unalaska, as well as three floating processors which serve even more remote locations. PSPA strongly supports this bill, SB 130, which would augment the existing fisheries product development tax credit. SB 130 provides an incentive for the Alaska seafood processors to invest in new equipment that produces higher quality, value-added products within Alaska. This will provide long-term economic benefits to the state, coastal communities, fishermen, and processors. The following are some important aspects of SB 130 that I'd like to point out. The bill does not change the current maximum value of the tax credit, which is capped at 50% of a processing company's Alaska fisheries business tax. The bill expands the types of equipment and the species eligible for the tax credit. The bill facilitates a one-time private investment in equipment that year after year will continue to increase the quality and utilization of each fish and value-added products as well. And this increases the long-term value of the fishery resource to all of the users, the state, the communities, fishermen, and processors. The bill will provide increased returns to the state and communities as fish taxes are based on fish value. The bill is supported by previous analysis by McKinley Research Group that showed a return on investment to the state general fund of over 200% for the original tax credit relative to salmon. The health of the seafood industry is critical to Alaska. Is that noise coming from me?
I am searching. Apparently it is, according to our audio person. Seems to have gone away.
Okay, I will continue.
All right.
The health of the seafood industry is critical to Alaska as it generates $6 billion a year in economic activity, and it's the state's largest manufacturing and export sector, and it also lowers the cost of transportation for all Alaskans. The Alaska seafood industry is facing historically challenging economic conditions, as you all heard and as the task force focused on. NOAA estimates the losses felt by Alaska in 2023 was $1.8 billion. While inventories have stabilized in 2024 due to USDA purchases of Alaska salmon and pollock, and the ban on Russian seafood took effect in May of 2024, other economic conditions have not significantly improved. So moving into 2025, there are still unknown risks related to trade and tariffs that are still significant. SB 130 will implement one of the near-term recommendations of the Legislative Seafood Task Force. The task force report focuses on a few key items within the state of Alaska's purview that would make a difference, with the primary understanding that in order to move the needle, we need to lower operating costs and increase product value. This bill will encourage one-time private investment that year after year will increase long-term value of the fishery resource. We very much appreciate the efforts of the Seafood Task Force and thank you for your time today. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Decker, I suppose you could probably answer my questions to revenue as well, but I'll hold those. I'm wondering about the 50% cap and the processors. How often do processors hit that cap? Is that something that most processors do most years, or certain processors do most years, or it almost never happens?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, our understanding through presentations by Department of Revenue to the task force is that on average, about $1 to $3 million a year. It's different by year, but that was around the range of the total tax credit, which meant many of the processors either weren't using it or not reaching the cap.
Follow-up, Senator Dunbar?
No, I think I'll ask the Department of Revenue.
Thank you. Senator Kawasaki?
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Decker. This expands the fish tax to any species as opposed to just salmon. And I think I remember when it was just salmon, and then there's been fisheries that have been added. Are there... I guess, is there a reason to exclude any fisheries? Because this will be pretty inclusive.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, I think if the state's interested in increasing value through quality improvements and also increasing value-added processing, which generally leads to more jobs and activity in the state, I don't see a reason to exclude any kind of fisheries. I think it would be more beneficial to those goals to have it open to any fishery. But also, one note, already the major fisheries in the state are already included, but this would just not exclude any of the smaller ones.
Follow-up, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And is it true to say that not every fishery is as stressed as some fisheries this year, or is it every species, every fisherman, every type of practice that's being hit equally?
I'm sorry, through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, you cut out on me a little bit. So I think the question was, are all fisheries feeling the same kind of economic challenges? Is that correct?
Pretty much. That's what I wanted to know.
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, thank you for the question. I would say they're not all equal, but generally in 2023, we really saw almost all fisheries impacted. Not 100%, but almost all fisheries have been impacted by this economic downturn.
Follow up, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you.
All right. Further questions for Ms. Decker? All right. Mr. Lampkin.
Tim Lampkin, Staff Senator Stevens. Just to build off that conversation and asking about the species, the task force spoke a lot about the species, and this started with, you're right, Senator Kawasaki, with salmon, and over the years we slowly added pollock and then herring, and through Senator Stevens' bill, cod and sablefish, for example. And so given the fact, and I'm sure Ms. Decker can correct me here, but that there are processors out there that operate in more than one fishery. And so if they're investing in equipment that might add value to, say, pick something like salmon, but yet they go into herring or some other fishery, and that the or some other fishery that's not included in the tax credit program, then it becomes problematic as to how much when it comes to applying for eligibility to credit, where does it apply and where does it not? And so to try to avoid that, plus the idea that every few years maybe we discover a new fishery in salmon sharks or in some other obscure thing that we may not have thought of yet, but the market emerges, and encourage that kind of investment and activity in that sector, that we not have to have a bill every few years to change the statute that it applies to that fishery. So that's kind of the backstory as to why they decided to just make it all species.
Very good. Any questions from committee members for Ms. Decker or Mr. Lampkin? All right, I'm going to go now then to Brandon Spanus. He is the Deputy Director, Division of Tax Division. Mr. Spanus, welcome.
Thank you. Again, for the record, Brandon Spanus, Deputy Director with the Department of Revenue, Tax Division. I'm available for any specific questions, or I can go over our fiscal note.
Let's see what specific questions. I know Senator Dunbar had some questions.
I guess the first one is, for some reason, I don't have the fiscal note for this one, and I don't know if other folks do. I have a fiscal note for 135, but not for 130. That might just be something I wasn't able to find. It was just posted. Okay, so I don't think anyone on this committee has the fiscal note, so it might answer my questions, Madam Chair.
Sure, it might. Mr. Spanos, can you simply verbally give us the fiscal note?
Yes, and the fiscal note is indeterminate, so I'm not sure, but it does give on page 2, there's a revenue impact, kind of an average high and a low scenario. And so I apologize that wasn't made available. I noticed it myself and pinged our folks, which is maybe why it just got posted. But the revenue impact, it's indeterminate because we don't know what the new utilization will look like and what the current downturn, how that might impact investments going forward. And so in an attempt to shine a light on potential impacts, again, we have a average, a high and a low scenario. And these were developed by scaling up our existing fisheries product development tax credit forecast to account for expanding to all species and to new equipment beginning January 1, 2025, and by accounting for the three-year extension, there's a carry-forward extension that's 3 years. So even though the credit will sunset in 2030, we have a 2031 number as well, because we anticipate 75% of the 2030 credit being utilized in 2031 as a carry-forward. So the average scenario looks like FY26 of an impact on revenue of a negative $1.01 million, 2027, $1.04 million, 2028, $2.06 million, 2029, 3.09 million. By 2030 would be 4.12 million, and FY 2031, 3.7 million. I'll just go over the first few years. For 2027, it would be 1.12 million, and the low would be a negative 0.9 million in 2027.
Very good. Thank you. Question, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that helped me. That was very useful. Can you give us a sense of sort of what taxes are impacted by this? And I know it's 50% of their total tax liability, but I assume that can't be applied to local taxes, only state taxes. So is it corporate income taxes? Are there only certain kinds of taxes? Or can you give me a sense of what kind of taxes are being paid by these processors that can be offset? And sort of, do you have a number of what is the total tax liability that those processors are currently paying?
Yes, I can answer those questions. It doesn't apply to the corporate income tax. It applies to our fisheries taxes. And it applies to our fisheries business tax, and I believe our fisheries resource landing tax, but I'm going to need a call on my lifeline, Chris Becker, who's our lead fish auditor, that can clarify that for me. And while he's answering that, I'll look up our annual numbers, or maybe if he has them, he can go over those as well.
Thank you. Mr. Becker, did you hear the question?
Yes. For the record, this is Chris Becker with the State of Alaska Tax Division. So this credit can only be claimed against the fishery and business tax. Of that tax in FY 2024, the total tax before credits was $35 million. And then FY 23, for context, was $51 million.
Follow-up, Senator Dunbar?
I guess just a comment then. That's a remarkably low utilization of the tax credits versus some of our other industries in Alaska. They had $51 million, and we heard they usually only claim $1 to $3 million a year. And granted, they can only take half, but that would still be $25 million of available tax credits, and they're only claiming $1 to $3 million. And it's just an interesting point, and I suppose it has to do with the relatively limited things that this can be applied to, which is certain kinds of capital purchases or tangible personal property with a useful life of 3 years or more. So, but that's all for now, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Other questions from committee members, either for Mr. Becker, Mr. Spanos, or Mr. Lampkin? All right, seeing none, thank you for that presentation. We'll set this bill aside for committee members to review, and we'll move on to Senate Bill 135, which is the refund for fish business tax to municipalities. So this is the first hearing of this bill also. Mr. Lampkin, if you'd like to review it for us.
For the record, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens and the Alaska Seafood Task Force. So this bill is inspired and modeled after a bill that was proposed in, I believe it was 2012. It's very much resembles that bill. It was in the context of during conversations at the task force to, as we're referring to it, as the fish tax revenue sharing concept, whereas in 1962, when this fisheries tax revenue sharing was first created, the amount of that sharing for qualified municipalities was 10%. It's evolved over the years from a series of congressional and territorial legislation originally to do with canneries, salmon, and other fisheries, but for the purposes of funding fisheries-related activities in coastal communities in the fisheries sector. Since that time, it's only increased twice, once in 1979 to 20%, and the last time this area has been touched that I have found so far in this research was in 1981 to what is and continues to be the 50% level. and that is to say the and our tax guys are certainly going to be available to go into more detail with this, but that generally that the municipalities have a 50% share. It's a refund. The fisheries business tax and fisheries landing resource taxes are shared between the state and the local governments. And this bill would, for example, just generally, not entirely, but generally shift it from a 50-50 to a 60-40 in favor of the local government. That's it in a sentence. I, again, don't purport to be an expert on the tax components of this. This bill does not change the actual tax level. It doesn't change any of the fisheries policies. These knobs and levers that could be turned are just simply to get something on the table, understanding that these numbers can change greatly. There was one point in the task force conversations where it was proposed, why don't we just shift it 100% to localities, 0% state, for example. Those are all things that are going to perhaps get talked about and negotiated and compromised as a bill such as this goes through the system. I believe it will largely be something that our finance folks are going to want to talk about at length. But that's the general concept of this bill, and I'm pleased to report that we have Mr. Niels Andreessen available with AML to discuss it as well.
Very good. Questions for the bill sponsor or staff? Yes, Senator Hughes.
Yeah, thank you, and I'm not fully up to speed, so I confess I'm a bit naive, but I'm looking at the fiscal note, and you said a 60-40 split. I am seeing a line here. It says the total revenue share with communities could be 60, 70, or 75%, depending on the tax and community types. Could you kind of explain this? Because, you know, as we move this share, we understand the coastal communities are hurting, but it means less for the state, too. So I'd just like to understand that range and how that would work.
So through the chair, Senator Hughes, really the best way to try to answer that question is to look at the bill itself or else through the sectional. The different types of qualified municipalities, there are unorganized boroughs, there's first, second-class cities, and so on and so forth. And depending on if they're in the municipality or they're in it, in or outside of it and so forth, that's what changes this split. And I didn't do a deep research on the history of how those policies came about, but it is clear that there were compromises, negotiations, the politics of the day that resulted in this statute and the way it's structured. I hope that starts to answer your question anyway.
Yes, and we do, again, have Chris Becker and Brandon Spanos online. We also have Hannah Lager, L-A-G-E-R, Administrative Services Director from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. So those three folks are online. Follow-up, Senator Hughes.
A follow-up. And, mm-hmm. and it does sound like it's a bit complicated. Maybe Department of Revenue could just let us know what the expected impact to the state would be.
Yes, and I do see that we have a fiscal note prepared here. But, Mr. Spanos, are you able to elaborate on Senator Hughes's question?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Hughes. Again, for the record, Brandon Spanos with Department of Revenue. The current structure of the share is a bit simpler than the language in this bill. I'm not sure if that was intended, but some of the changes to the fisheries business tax are a little bit different than the fisheries development tax. That may have just been an oversight, but that's where you get the 60, 70, and 75% split depending on the different community types. Currently, the way this statute works, it's more of a 50-50 split. So if the intent is to do a 60-40 split, I would be happy to share some amended language options to get to that 60-40 split. Which would be generally then a 30% to the city, 30% to the borough if the city is in an organized borough, and then 40 to the state. The way that it's currently structured, because of the share to DCCED, Department of Commerce and Economic Development, there is a 75% share
when the community gets less than 75% share. So in every case, the current structure, as I read it, is a 75-25% split. So 75% goes either to local communities or to DCCED to be shared out with local communities. In a different, I don't know how their allocation program works, but it wouldn't be allocated quite the same way that we would distribute it when it's shared with them. And so our fiscal note assumes a 75-25% split. You can see the numbers in the note itself, but in the first year, fiscal year 26, it's a negative $12.3 million impact. And the way the budget is written is that it's appropriated in the current budget, but it wouldn't be paid out until the next budget year. And then in the fiscal year 2031, the impact would be a negative $16.8 million.
Follow-up, Senator Hughes? Further questions? Senator Myers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So looking in the bill, there's a kind of a stair-step method if a new city is created inside of a borough to, over the course of a few years, alter the spread there. I didn't see anything, though, that if there's a new borough created encompassing a city. So, you know, just as one example, what if a new borough was created that included Valdez, which is, you know, currently outside of a borough? Does something like that exist in statute? Do we need to address that?
And your question is for?
The bill sponsor, I believe.
All right. Mr. Lampkin?
Thank you, through the Chair, Senator Myers. I am going to defer to our tax guys on that matter, else perhaps AML.
Okay.
Mr. Spanos, do you have any comment on that, or Mr. Becker?
I'm going to call on my lifeline, Mr. Becker. I am not as familiar with that portion of statute. I know that the stair-step method is already in statute, and this bill would simply change the amounts that are shared to those communities depending on how long they've incorporated.
All right. Mr. Becker, any comment?
For the record, this is Chris Becker with the State of Alaska Tax Division. So currently only we do not have that currently in statute.
Thank you.
Okay.
Follow-up, Senator Myers?
No, but I do have a different question for the bill sponsor, if you'd like.
Yes, go ahead.
All right. So I was looking through the sponsor statement, and it looks like a lot of the impetus behind the fish tax revenue sharing has to do with maintaining the harbors that the state handed over to the to a lot of the municipalities. But it's mentioned in the sponsor statement that if in the event that the municipality is unable to maintain the harbor facilities, that the title reverts back to the state for that harbor. Rather than changing the revenue sharing, have any of the municipalities reach out to the state or consider just handing the harbor facilities back to the state instead?
Mr. Lampkin?
Not that I know of.
Oh.
No. Okay. Is that something that maybe we should look at as a policy, as an alternative to changing the revenue sharing?
Senator Stevens?
I don't think you'd see that happen in most communities, fishing communities. Yeah. It's really been interesting that as we were having hearings, we heard from several communities, and a lot of communities, on the impact that the downturn in the industry is having on them. Some communities like King Cove and St. Paul and the Pribilofs have lost their processors entirely, and we realize there's nothing we can do to help them. But other communities like the ones that we've been talking about here, a small assistance will be tremendous to them. It'll have a major impact. And actually, I don't think there are some of this. I believe there are some communities out there that have not yet realized the impact that reduction is going to have on them. So this is an attempt, not necessarily to be used for harbor facilities, used for anything else, but an attempt to help them through this very tough time. And there is an end in sight, too. It's not forever.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, thank you. Sort of along the similar lines on the question that it sounds like this was the tax revenues originally were supposed to go to municipalities in order to help the legislative intent basically says to maintain and improve the municipal facilities. Does that actually happen?
Your question is for who?
Probably whoever can answer the question.
right? Are you talking tax division?
I think it's probably to the tax division because we automatically, I'm guessing, remit checks to each of the municipalities or municipal governments. I'm just curious if that does go through or does it go to their general fund and they do it, or maybe if we can hear just a little bit on that.
Mr. Spanos, did you hear Senator Kawasaki's question and can you answer?
Can I get it repeated?
Could you repeat, please?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the for being online. The question is that the legislative intent, Section 1, the uncodified language, has to deal with making sure that the money that's collected through this landing tax goes to the municipalities that have those particular ports. And I was just asking whether that is the case that communities that are getting this fishing landing tax use it for their port maintenance, upkeep, and other types of things, or if that's ever known, or does it just go rolled into a general fund?
Thank you for the question, Senator Kawasaki. Through the chair, I don't believe that is that language is in current statute. The money be spent on that that infrastructure. So I believe it just goes into the community's local general fund.
And that was Mr. Spanos, I believe, answering. Mr. Lampkin?
Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens and the Seafood Task Force. Senator Kawasaki, if you refer to page 4, section 8 of the bill, to my knowledge, presently there's no specific reporting on this matter, but there is a component of this bill that would ask the municipalities to begin reporting on that's the business fisheries business tax, and then on page 8, section 15, would have a similar report on the landing tax fisheries monies and to indicate how the monies are being spent. And yes.
In addition, for invited testimony, we do have Nils Andreasen with AML. Are there questions now for the bill sponsor or Department of Revenue? Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One point on what Senator Kawasaki just said, it'll be interesting to see those reports and if they actually are being used on harbors. And I would argue that we as a state should not be too strict with these communities, that the money just goes to harbors if they're currently going to. There's a lot of things that make these communities livable for our fishing communities, you know. And maybe it makes sense to refurbish the public library and wait for a different kind of capital grant to fix the harbor. But sort of related to that, I wanted to ask the tax division. So there's a lot of language in here about it being subject to appropriation, and you know, we can't have dedicated funds, but we can have designated funds in the legislature or in the state. And so I'm wondering, you know, have we always followed this formula? Has there been cases where, for whatever reason, the state felt like we couldn't pay out this full amount in the past? And if there is a time in the future where we feel that's the case, is the state really bound by this language, or could this money still end up in the state's general fund?
The question being for Mr. Spanos?
Yes.
Mr. Spanos?
Again, for the record, Brandon Spanos, Department of Revenue. To my knowledge, as long as I've been here, which is 15 plus years, the money has always been appropriated to the designated fund that's been shared with the communities. We do have a sharing report that's published annually. So last year in FY24, we shared out $16.17 million from the fisheries business taxes to the local communities. And I did get just an instant message on that I'm going to read here. During COVID, we matched previous year's share. So there was 1 year where we actually the legislature appropriated more funds than were available to match up to the prior year to make up for those COVID years. But other than that, the money that's been collected has been appropriated out of those designated funds.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So I think at this point, let's go to invited testimony. Mr. Andreasen is here. He is the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. So I will invite him to come forward and give us his testimony on Senate Bill 135. Welcome, Mr. Andreasen.
Thank you. For the record, Nils Andreasen, I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. Feel like I should try to address a lot of the topics that came up, but maybe I will stick to my prepared remarks and then address any questions that are remaining.
That'd be great.
So thank you again for the opportunity to testify today. I'm here representing local governments across Alaska. Our mission at AML is to strengthen the cities and boroughs of the state. We appreciate the work of the Alaska Seafood Industry Task Force and the thoughtful consideration of this bill, which reflects recommendations aimed at enhancing support for coastal communities. We're supportive of the intent of SB 135 to increase the share of fisheries tax revenue distributed to municipalities. This recognition of the important role that local governments play in supporting the seafood industry and providing services that benefit fisheries-dependent communities is welcomed and appreciated. Alaska's coastal cities and boroughs are essential to the operation and success of the state seafood industry. Local governments own and maintain the majority of ports and harbors across the state, managing critical infrastructure that enables the safe and efficient movement of significant volumes of seafood. Many of these facilities are aging and require ongoing investment to ensure their continued functionality and safety. The revenue provided through fisheries taxes is essential for maintaining these assets and supporting the broader network of services and infrastructure that enable this industry to thrive. Further, the benefits of this revenue extend beyond infrastructure maintenance. It supports emergency services, transportation systems, housing, and other community needs that directly and indirectly benefit the industry. For many of Alaska's municipalities, fisheries-related revenue provides essential funding that contributes to overall community well-being and economic resilience. As you work to move this bill forward, we would like to respectfully raise a few points for consideration that we believe would strengthen this legislation. First, not all recipients of fisheries tax revenue maintain or operate harbor facilities. While we recognize the importance of maintaining and improving these facilities for the benefit of the industry, a requirement to allocate additional funds specifically for this purpose may not be applicable or practical for all local governments. For instance, the business tax that is shared includes the communities of Houston and Anderson, which aren't coastal, but where businesses are located that contribute to the industry. Another wrinkle is to consider is that while a borough like Kodiak Island Borough receives a share, it's the city of Kodiak that actually has the powers for ports and harbors. And between them, they would have to figure out a way to transfer those funds outside of the powers that the borough currently has. So in our opinion, it's really important that flexibility in the use of these funds should be considered to ensure that all recipients can utilize them in ways that best support their communities. It's critical, I think, to consider this increase in revenue sharing as additive rather than a replacement for other types of state investment. Local governments depend on a predictable and reliable revenue stream to meet their obligations and to provide services that benefit the industry and community members alike. This legislation should make clear that other forms of state support are not to be diminished as a result. For instance, AML last surveyed port and harbor infrastructure improvement needs in 2019 and identified $600 million and as much as $1 billion if you include the Port of Alaska. We'll recreate that survey this year, but the scale of need is important to evaluate and ensure that together we are appropriately meeting the needs of these communities relative to the industries dependent on improvements. Finally, we're concerned about the potential administrative burden associated with the requirement for annual reports. For many local governments, particularly those that receive only a minimal amount of revenue from this program, the cost of compliance may exceed the benefit of the increased share. We recommend the committee consider ways to streamline reporting requirements to ensure that they are not unnecessarily burdensome. I noted payments of the fisheries business tax in FY23 to two communities of $244 and $214 each. So we have to think about the increase involved for those communities and whether it actually increases their ability to improve facilities or simply complete the annual report due to the legislature that will now be necessary. So perhaps there are alternatives to achieve the same goal. The Alaska Municipal League and its members are supportive of finding additional ways in which the state may contribute to investments in coastal communities. And we recommend the task force and this committee, and we commend the task force and this committee for its consideration and the bill sponsor for bringing this forward. We appreciate your willingness to consider these suggested improvements and look forward to continuing to work with you to enhance this legislation for the benefit of not just local governments, but the seafood industry that is interdependent. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. We really appreciate the very specific input. Senator Dunbar had a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Andreessen, for being here. That last point you made about the reporting requirements, and, you know, one community gets $240, and obviously it's not really worth it for them to do a report. Do you happen to have the numbers on you in terms of, you know, kind of what's the high end, and is there a logical sort of cutoff? You know, what if we said if you receive 10,000 or more, or 50,000 or more, you know, is there a logical number we could choose where it goes from sort of de minimis to worth them doing it, and simultaneously worth us as a legislature understanding where the funds are going? We want to count every penny, but maybe we don't need a whole report for $240.
Senator Dunbar, through the chair. I don't have the numbers on me. I imagine a Department of Revenue does. I don't know. I think it would ultimately be up to each community to figure out what's worth it. And I don't want to use worth it in the wrong way at all. I think that any increase of shared revenue is a positive thing for local governments who are using those funds for all kinds of community needs. But ultimately, they've got a very complicated harbor improvement plan and capital improvement plan, other needs in their communities. They'll have to weigh what kinds of considerations go into each. So it might not be as easy as saying this community gets $1.7 million and this gets $214, and there's a line in the middle that we should draw. It really needs to be based on their own circumstances. I would also offer that really the harbor improvements and you know the target for these funds, if I understand the legislative intent proposed in this legislation, we should also think about which communities need it, right? When we're surveying communities for the port and harbor improvements that they have on their list, not everybody has the same level of need, so everybody would see an increase from this legislation. But needs would vary pretty dramatically between communities. So we want to really structure this to be responsive to the communities who need it most, responsive to how communities might apply this differently, and then figure out how to right-size it depending on the resources that are available to each community.
Thank you. Follow-up, Senator Dunbar.
I'll just say I understand from the community's perspective that it's sort of a holistic, you know, looking at the value versus the time. Unfortunately, we are in the business of drawing arbitrary lines, you know, 60%, 50%, 25%, 35%. And so it might be that we just choose a line for administrative simplicity and sort of, you know, that's where we do it. I will say also on the sort of the idea of it going, you know, being targeted to the right places, that really isn't how this bill is structured. That at least is how I'm reading it. And maybe there's an argument to be made that in theory, that is sort of our capital grants process, that capital grants are supposed to be targeted to the highest need, as opposed to something like this that is more of a blanket, you know, almost like community sharing of the wealth. And I would argue that sort of maintains more flexibility. But that's all, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Any other questions for Mr. Andreessen? Yes, Mr. Andreessen.
Sorry.
Further comments?
Chair, maybe just to follow up really quickly on Senator Dunbar's, this is the fairest way to distribute these funds, right? Everybody gets an increase across the board. The other way to it, I mean, the recommendation in the task force report is 100%. So if we want to draw a line, just set the bar really high and make it available to all. I think what I wanted to communicate today is a willingness to work with this committee, with the bill sponsor and the legislature, to make sure this is a right fit for everybody involved. A lot of the recommendations that came out of the Seafood Task Force are interdependent, right? There are lots of different levers that you can pull that connect, and local governments have a role in most of them, whether it's workforce development or tax structure or infrastructure development. So we want to think about those things holistically, and AML and our members, happy to be part of those conversations. And as part of that negotiation of next steps. So we just want to make sure this is a good fit for everybody. And again, nothing that I have said, I think, should be interpreted as unwillingness to participate in those conversations or you know, a lack of appreciation for the bill sponsor who's brought this forward. There's just work that we want to do to make sure it's able to move forward successfully. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Andreessen. Good. Inviting the bill sponsor and Mr. Lampkin back. Do you have any further comments or closing remarks?
Well, Senator Gary Stevens, I'm really pleased to hear what Nels had to say, and I think he's right. You know, I told you there are two communities that we figured we just can't help at all because they've lost their only processor, and they'll have no – there's no way we can give them some advantage by giving them a bigger share of the state's tax. So I think it makes sense to me that that those monies go to those communities and they use them how best they see fit. The at this time – you know, as I say, I don't know all of them realize how bad things are going to be. And it is going to be very tough. Our coastal communities are facing some real problems in the next couple of years as we work through the industry issues. And so the issue of going into a general fund of communities is fine. I think that's just as well. And they will decide where best to use those monies.
Very good. Any last-minute questions for the bill sponsor or Mr. Lemkin? Thank you very much for bringing these bills forward. We will set Senate Bill 135 aside and take it up at a later date. I'm expecting soon, as in perhaps next week, if you want to work with Mr. Andreessen, and I invite committee members to jump right in on this one. Both of these bills, actually. We want to move these fishery bills forward. Thank you very much, Senator Stevens and Mr. Lemkin. All right, the next subject on our agenda today is House Joint Resolution 11, Recognizing Alaska-Canada Relationship. Here to present today is Representative Chuck Kopp. He represents District 10, and his staff, Julia O'Connor. So, welcome, Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Senator Giesel and committee members. Really appreciate being here in this esteemed body of this committee, and thank you for being a lot of the energy behind this effort, Madam Co-Chair. Chair. My name is Chuck Kopp. I represent House District 10 in beautiful Senate District E, and I'm accompanied today by Julia O'Connor on my team. I'll just get right to it.
Yes, Chair. Please. Say, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Giesel, this resolution, more than anything, is to present a unified voice of restoration and reconciliation among old allies and friends at a time when trade restrictions have jeopardized and challenged that relationship. It really is not about anything that is partisan or ideological. It just represents the endearing ties between Alaska and Canada, about the way we work together, and about the way we respond to challenges together. It's an unqualified affirmation of our shared history, mutual defense, talking militarily and then community to community, that have bound our state to Canada over centuries. And the trust and affection that we hold for our Canadian neighbors extends to their identity as citizens of the sovereign nation of Canada. Just to begin with, we have a history that's woven together. I know this committee is very familiar with that. We can't imagine Alaska without Canada. No road connecting us to the lower 48, no supply routes for fuel and goods, no shared Arctic strategy. Long before modern borders, indigenous people moved freely across what is now Alaska and Canada, trading and sharing knowledge and building deep cultural ties. During World War II, the U.S. and Canada worked together to build the Alaska-Canada Highway, and what started as a wartime necessity became a permanent economic artery between Alaska and Canada. Many of us have driven the Elkhorn. We've visited Prince Rupert or crossed the border to visit friends in Yukon or British Columbia, and we know what the connectedness is firsthand to Canada. Alaskans and Canadians play on the same sport teams. Many of you have attended the Arctic Winter Games. You know the connection between the Alaskan and Canadian communities. Commercial truck drivers, businesses and workers cross these borders every day. Fishing crews, tourism guides, and miners rely on the Canadian routes and ports to do their jobs. There's no question Canada is an economic lifeline for Alaska. The resolution highlights the importance of the trading partnership. $596 million in Alaskan exports, just Alaska alone, go to Canada, and we import $753 million annually. Without Canada, Alaska's economy would be cut off from key markets and critical supply chains. Our grocery stores are literally filled with fresh vegetables, dairy, and packaged goods that arrive through Canadian supply chains. Fishermen in southeast Alaska depend on Canadian ports to process their fish. Alaska's oil and mining industries are tied to Canadian investments, creating jobs and ensuring our resources reach the world. More than 23,000 Alaskans have jobs connected to Canadian trade, and over 47 Canadian-owned businesses operate right here in the state. We are strong allies in defense and security. Our veterans here on this committee know that Alaska and Canada have stood on battlefields together, shoulder to shoulder, since World War II. Since the War on Terror, our troops have always fought side by side, defending our shared democratic values. Alaska is a home to NORAD, the Northern American Aerospace Defense Command, and where American and Canadian forces monitor the skies and protect North America's security. When disaster strikes, Canada always answers the call. After 911, when the U.S. airspace shut down, many of us know it was actually that the command of NORAD is traded on a regular basis back and forth. It was the Canadians actually were on duty securing our airspace and making sure that U.S. travelers had a place to land in Canada during that time. Wildfire season, Canadians and Alaskans routinely cross the borders to take care of each other during wildfire season. And we particularly are sensitive to each other's weather shutdowns on our roads, ensuring fuel and critically needed supplies keep cross-border communities going. We're just there for each other. I've highlighted the mutual guardians of the Arctic that we are, that we ensure development is being done responsibly and our communities remain resilient. One of the things that Canadians and Alaskans really understand is that strong communities make a strong Arctic and they make strong nations. And we understand that being up here in the north. Just in closing, Madam Chair, everything about our relationship with Canada matters at this time, not just because of the current stress, but it seems like in the global uncertainty that we're facing, we are more keenly aware of why neighbors matter, why partners matter, and everything in our life we can tie to groceries and fuel and things like that, and cooperation. And ultimately, it does come down to relationships matter. And this resolution, more than anything, is just standing up to protect that relationship, because keeping our relationship with Canada isn't just good policy. It's really who Alaskans are, and we recognize it's essential to our way of life. That's the overview. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. So we won't go through a explanation of changes today because we have four people online who wish to testify, and they've been waiting. So I would like to give them opportunity. So I'm going to move directly into invited testimony on HJR 11. And first up is Honorary Ranj Plia. He is the Premier of Yukon Territory, Canada. Premier Plia, welcome to the Senate Resources Committee. If you would introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, my name is Premier Ranj Plia. I want to thank senators for giving me the opportunity to be with you today. I would like to also thank Alaska State Representative Kopp for inviting me to provide testimony before the Senate Resources Committee today on House Joint Resolution 11, recognizing and honoring the relationship between Canada and Alaska. I'm joining you from the traditional territories of the Kwalin-Dun First Nation and the Ton Kwachin Council in Whitehorse, Yukon. Since my testimony before the Alaska's House Resources Committee, there has been a great deal of discussion about upcoming tariffs promised by the U.S. administration for April 2nd. Just last week, Canada's new Prime Minister, Mark Carney, let us know that he had a call with President Trump, and this was his first since becoming Prime Minister in January. In what was described as a very constructive call, we were told that there was agreement between President Trump and Prime Minister Carney to begin negotiations about a new economic and security relationship. The Prime Minister also held a meeting with premiers where we discussed the potential impacts of tariffs promised for April 2nd, as well as our collective potential response. Here in the Yukon, we have also been considering our economic and security relationship with the United States. On one hand, life in the North means that Alaskans and Yukoners share similar challenges. We share common goals of improving the lives of our citizens, promoting responsible economic development, innovating in the North, and making life more affordable. But on the other hand, Canadians feel that our economy and our national sovereignty is now at risk. Alaska's border with Canada is no longer than that of any other state in the U.S. And not surprisingly, cross-border trade has always been a reality for us in the North. Indigenous trading routes like the Chilkoot Pass and the Dalton Trail were vital to the Klondike Gold Rush. This led to the White Pass and the Yukon Route Railway and the construction of the Alaska Highway during World War II. This highway remains strategically important for our economy and yours. We do not believe that any Yukoners or Alaskans are better off when the ability to move people and goods across the border is impeded. Like all good neighbors, when times are tough, Alaskans and Yukoners are there for each other. The sinking of the Princess Sophia in 1918 was just the start of a cross-border cooperation in tumultuous times. Today, we share firefighting resources through the Northwest Compact and cooperate on search and rescue as committed to in the Arctic Search and Rescue Agreement. Our international airport in Whitehorse serves as a critical transit point for the U.S. Air Force and as a refueling and emergency landing location, as it did most notably on September 11th, 2001. We share a love of sports and recreation. Events like the Chilkat International Bike Relay, the Alcan 200 Snowmobile Race, the Dust Bowl Softball Tournament, the Buckwheat Ski Classic, and the Klondike Road Relay rely on participants and support from both sides of the border. And many businesses in the Yukon and Alaska rely on cross-border tourism. Tariffs, however, put all this at risk. Tariffs and the threats to Canada's economic and national sovereignty has created chaos, challenges, and disruption for people and businesses on both sides of the border. Ultimately, these tariffs are passed on to every citizen, business, worker, and consumer in the U.S. and Canada. More than 20,000 Alaskans and 7.8 million Americans have built their lives and livelihoods around the rules-based international order defined in NAFTA and its successor treaty, the USMCA. As it says in this joint resolution, the alliance between Alaska and Canada is about many more years of cooperation, friendship, trade, tourism, cultural exchange, and goodwill. I urge the Alaskan Senate to stand up for the Alaskan jobs, Alaskan workers, and Alaskan businesses that depend on trade with Canada. We must continue to work together to protect the livelihood of our citizens and our economies. Here in Canada, we will continue to do our part as well, protecting our economy and fighting against the criminals and drug traffickers that hurt so many people in our communities. We will keep standing up for our sovereignty and building up on our defense capacity as an Arctic nation. But I want to be clear, Canada will never be the 51st state. In closing, I want to emphasize that Canada's response to tariffs and our efforts to protect our economy and sovereignty are not a reflection of our feelings towards the American people. We remain your greatest friends and your closest allies. We want to keep working together, just like we've done for the past 150 years. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak here today and for your time. Thank you. Merci. Shonithan. Merci, Joe.
Mr. Premier, it's an honor to have you testify to us today. Thank you very much. As a lifelong Alaskan, I agree with every word you said 100%. And I can also say genuinely, I love Canadians because my youngest son is a dual citizen. Lives in a different province than you, but regardless. Any questions from committee members for the premier? Seeing, yes, Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you for being here today. You mentioned your prime minister has had an initial phone call and begun negotiations. Do you know when the next plan meeting between the president and the prime minister is planned?
Yeah, I would say, Senator, but we haven't, and thank you for the question, I would say we have not started negotiations. I think it was the first intro call, but now we are in the middle of a federal election. So that federal election will conclude on April 28th. And at that point, we will see who the Prime Minister of Canada is. So we're in a period now where the tariffs are still moving forward in the next couple of days. There will be probably a very significant response from Canada that's been set in motion to see based on what we know. And then we will see as we get to the end of April who the new Prime Minister of Canada is.
Just thank you for that explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Premier. I see no further questions. Again, we really appreciate you taking the time to testify today. Thank you.
Thank you. Also an honor for me to be able to speak to your committee. Thank you all, senators.
Thank you. With that, we'll go on to the next testifier, invited testifier, who is Matt Morrison, Executive Director of the Pacific Northwest Economic Region. Mr. Morrison, can you hear us?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, welcome to the committee.
Okay, Madam Chair. Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm grateful to be there. Alaska's so important to this region and so important to me. Since 1991, Alaska has been a founding member of the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, of which I'm the executive director. And this is a statutory organization created, as I mentioned, in 1991, dedicated to enhancing cooperation and sharing best practices between states, provinces, and territories. I think that as has been mentioned, the relationship between Canada and Alaska is very significant, and I would urge support for this resolution. It means so much more than just the words. Senator Lisa McGuire established PennWest Arctic Caucus in 2009, and we have had annual meetings in Washington, D.C., bringing together the subnational organizations with Alaska, Yukon, and Northwest Territories, and Nunavut to talk about the importance of the Arctic in Washington, D.C. We think that I'm glad that the resolution before you talks about the Shakwak. I think this is a really important aspect. We have been working closely with our colleagues in British Columbia, and we do feel that it's very important to make sure there is no reduction in or any restriction on passage through the Alcan Highway. And we have been instrumental in supporting the RAISE grant for the Shakwak, which has been successful, and we don't want to see that go away. So it's very important to both Alaska and Canada to make sure that our transportation routes, land, sea, and air, are secured. I think that, you know, I always come back to President Kennedy when he first went to Ottawa and said, geography has made us neighbors, history has made us friends, economics has made us partners, and necessity has made us allies. Those whom nature hath so joined together, let no man put asunder. And I do believe that it's been very moving to me to have all of our PennWest past presidents come together and issue a joint statement, which I will send for the record, supporting this relationship. And I think that Alaska has been such an important part of Penwar and the region. And I just want to thank Representative Kopp and those who have supported this thus far, and say that this is a really important, I would call it a heartistic thing. It's not just the culture, but it's the friendship, it's the family relationships that tie us together. And it's so important to say it. So I really appreciate, I hope that this committee can support this resolution. And thank you so much for allowing me to present some testimony today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Morrison. We would be very interested in that joint statement from past Penwar presidents. I also appreciated the resolution that came forward from Penwar. So, yes, if you would send that to us, we'll make sure it's part of the legislative record here. Thank you. Senator Hughes has a question, briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Morrison, for being here. Oh, you went away for a second. You're back. There was a March 27th article in the Yukon News, and it stated that the funding for the Shakwak Road had already been paused. Is that accurate?
Well, I'm not certain, but I know that a lot of funding that is paused has not been withdrawn. So I wouldn't take that as being the final statement.
Thank you.
Very good. I see no other questions, Mr. Morrison. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us tonight. Next up, invited testimony is John Rada. He is the president of the Arctic Winter Games International Committee. He's calling in from Eagle River. Mr. Rada, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you so much. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Joint Resolution Number 11. My name is John Rada. I am also a lifelong Alaskan and president of the Arctic Winter Games International Committee. I want to thank Representative Kopp for moving HJR 11 forward and also Premier Pillai's testimony today. I want to emphasize the value of sports and cultural exchange between Alaska and our Canadian neighbors. And the decades-long relationship between Alaska, Canada, and the Arctic Winter Games. I want to highlight the Arctic Winter Games specifically as they are a foundation for youth engagement, cross-border cooperation, and cultural celebration. Alaska and its Canadian counterparts have demonstrated an unwavering commitment to strengthening ties through sport and culture for over 50 years. The Arctic Winter Games, founded in 1967 and first held in Yellowknife Northwest Territories in 1970, is a testament to the enduring partnership among Alaska, Yukon Territory, and Northwest Territories. These games signify more than just athletic competition. They celebrate the rich cultural heritage of the circumpolar north and provide an opportunity for our youth to connect in meaningful ways. Since its inception, the Arctic Winter Games have evolved from its founding members, Alaska, Yukon, and the Northwest Territories, into a vibrant event that now includes seven permanent partners: Northern Alberta, Nunavut, Greenland, and Sapmi, which is the region of Norway, Finland, and Sweden. And they are the premier circumpolar event for northern youth above the 55th parallel. The Arctic Winter Games bring together 2,000 athletes, coaches, mission staff, and cultural performers biannually. These participants showcase the best talents from across the Arctic region, connected by a shared passion for sports and mutual appreciation for each other's cultures. The games offer a unique opportunity for youth to forge lasting relationships and improve their skills and foster understanding across borders. Alaska has hosted the Arctic Winter Games several times, beginning in Anchorage in 1970 and most recently in 2024 in Senator Hughes District in the Mat-Su Borough. The next games are scheduled for Whitehorse in 2026. And to sum up, I strongly encourage the sponsors of both House Joint Resolution Number 11 and Senate Joint Resolution Number 9 to emphasize the tremendous value of sports and our longstanding relationships with our Canadian partners. These relationships are about friendly competition, collaboration, shared experiences, and a power of cultural exchange. The Arctic Winter Games embody these values and more, and we look forward to continuing this important tradition. Thank you, and I am happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rada. I see no questions. I appreciate you being online and testifying. Thank you. And the last invited testifier is Sarah Frampton. She is the executive director of Arctic Team Alaska. Ms. Frampton, calling in from Fairbanks, welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Sarah Frampton, and I am the executive director of Arctic Winter Games Team Alaska, and I'm calling from Fairbanks. I am also here to speak in support of House Joint Resolution 11, recognizing the enduring relationship between the state of Alaska and Canada. This relationship is more than just a matter of geography. With a shared border stretching over 1,500 miles, Alaska and Canada are true neighbors and friends. Our histories and our values and our daily realities are deeply intertwined. From rural communities to urban centers, Alaskans and Canadians live with many of the same challenges, and we meet them with the same spirit of resilience, cooperation, and pride in where we're from. For decades, we worked side by side on everything from trade and infrastructure to education, emergency response, and environmental stewardship. But to me, one of the most inspiring aspects of this relationship is how it uplifts our young people with hockey tournaments, ski events, and all sorts of different sporting events, and especially through the international events like the Arctic Winter Games. In March 2026, the Arctic Winter Games will be hosted in White Horse, Yukon. Team Alaska will send 355 youth athletes, coaches, and staff to represent our great state on this international stage. But these games are about so much more than competition. They are a celebration of shared culture, northern identity, and the power of sport bringing people together. For the young people who participate, this impact is lifelong. They will return home with a new confidence, a stronger sense of self, friendships that cross borders and cultures. They learn to be ambassadors, not just for Alaska, but for the entire circumpolar north. These games honor indigenous traditions, highlight cultural diversity, and instill values of sportsmanship, leadership, and pride in where you come from. These transformative experiences they're just only possible because of these strong and trusted relationships we have with our northern neighbors, especially Canada. When our athletes arrive in the Yukon, I know they will be welcomed not just as competitors, but as friends. And that deep sense of belonging, of shared heritage and mutual respect is rare, and it's powerful, and it deserves to be honored and protected. The Arctic Winter Games unite regions across the circumpolar north. In addition to Alaska, several provinces and territories from Canada, participants from delegations in Greenland, including Nunavut, Northwest Territories, Yukon, Northern Alberta, Nunavut, Quebec, and the indigenous Sami people from Northern Europe. These young athletes come from different nations and cultures, but they all meet on the same playing field as equals, as friends, and as future leaders of the North. In supporting HJR 11, this is a recognition of that friendship. It affirms that Alaska and Canada are more alike than we are different. It acknowledges that we are not just neighbors. We are partners, collaborators, and Northern people working toward a common future. And most of all, it shows our commitment to investing in the next generation of Alaskans to the kinds of cross-cultural, life-changing opportunities that the Arctic Winter Games can provide. I respectfully urge to pass this resolution and let's stand with our youth in Alaska as they step into their role as the leaders of the North. And with that, I would welcome any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Frampton. I don't see any questions. Thank you for calling in today. That concludes our invited testimony. I'm going to open public testimony now. I see one person online wishing to testify named Mike Coons calling in from Wasilla. Mr. Coons, please identify yourself for the record, and I will allow you 2 minutes of testimony. Please begin.
Yes, my name is Mike Coons from Wasilla, and I'm speaking for myself. The whereas, which clearly warns Canada that the funding of Shakwik Road would be pulled if Canada closed the Alkang, I fully support. This Wednesday, President Trump imposes reciprocal tariffs on Canada. The original intent of this resolution prior to the amendment passing was pure top politics in this and the other body. President Trump is the person under Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution who has to say so on tariffs. Canada has imposed 200%+ tariffs on milk, wood, oil, etc. President Trump and USMCA trade deal did some great things to equalize things from NAFTA. I can't speak for the president, but I would bet USMCA was designed to end tariffs to Canada. Canada did not. Now President Trump has the support of the Republican-controlled Congress and the American people. Thus, Canada will pay in tariffs what they demand of us, or they can reduce those tariffs with like tariff reductions by the U.S. What with Canada's actions in Ontario, withholding electricity, threats of tolls, and or blocking transportation of needed supply chain material, a resolution of support for President Trump and his negotiations with Canada from a position of strength would be welcomed. What I find appalling is the lack of this body and other body and the other body of support in the opening of our land to producing for all Alaskans and our nation our oil and minerals. This Democrat rhino's so-called majority is more concerned with blocking President Trump in favor of another country, Canada, than it is making America and Alaska great again. Let this resolution die in committee. Thank you for hearing me out.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Coons. I see no one else online who wishes to testify. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on House Joint Resolution 11? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. Representative Kopp, thank you for bringing this resolution forward. I think it represents the alignment of Arctic people, Canadian and U.S., which sometimes is disconnected from the east coast of our two countries. So thank you very much for this resolution. We're going to set it aside right now, though it is my intent to bring it up very soon again. And at that time, we'll go through the explanation of changes.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. So this concludes our meeting for today. But before I move on to the next meeting, I do want to remind folks, in case you missed it, there is an amendment deadline being set for Senate Bill 92. This is the corporate income tax, oil and gas entities, for this Wednesday, April 2nd at 8 a.m. Amendments may be sent to my office. The next meeting will be Wednesday, April 2nd at 3:30 in the afternoon. And on the agenda will be, surprisingly, Senate Bill 92, corporate income tax, oil and gas entities. So at this time, we will stand adjourned. The time is 5:02 p.m.